Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting of the House Ag Policy Committee to order. And we do have two bills that we're going to be hearing. The first one is House File 1829. And that is Representative Clark Johnson. While he's getting himself prepared, we do have not yet a quorum, I believe. Andrew's here. So Representative Johnson will be presenting his bill along with some testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. And I believe I start by moving that this bill be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Very good. All right.
And furthermore, I'd like to move an amendment for the bill. It's the A1.
And that should be in everyone's packet, so you have the A1 amendment. Do you want to just give a brief description of what the amendment is?
The question was how to best describe the posting of a warning sign or what that sign should look like. And so we drew upon current law that relates, I believe, to like horse farms. And so we thought we'd draw upon what's already out there. I kind of like to do that.
Okay, and so you're moving the A1 amendment. Any
yep.
discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We don't have a quorum yet, so we're going to have to wait because we still don't have a quorum. We're waiting for a couple more people. So even though we did that, we're going to talk about the bill.
We'll talk about the bill.
As it would be amended, and then as we get a couple more people in here, we'll be able to take further action. But
fine. Well, this is the bill I like to talk about because I think this bill is about agritourism, and the idea is to promote agritourism in throughout Minnesota, which as I grew up as a city slicker from North Dakota, and so which is sometimes an anomaly, but it is a case of learning on the farm. And my family did not farm, but I've spent a lot of time at relatives' farms, and then recently this summer, I was invited to visit a number of farms in my area. And I found that to be both educational and, frankly, a lot of fun. And I think there's a lot of potential in terms of tourism itself. But as an educator myself, I also think that there's a lot of value in it for educational purposes. We know that very few people farm anymore. And yet agriculture is absolutely essential to the economy of this state. And for agriculture to thrive, I think it thrives better as more people understand the industry. And I don't think there's a better way to understand it or learn about it and to enjoy it than actually visiting a farm. I know in my area there's some rather large events. In early July, there's an event that draws thousands to a farm in the western end of Nicollet County. And I think that's true throughout the state. And I think so there's also some potential for tourism, as we would see it more in the fashion that we see in the resort country and the lake country. So I think this is a pretty good bill. And so I just like to defer the focus of the bill is to address the question of civil liability, because there's inherent risk when you're on a farm. You know, I own a tree farm, I think you know, and there's gopher holes and there's tree stumps and that's just part of walking around my property, and that's part of the experience. And I think there's some inherent risk involved with traipsing around a farm if you're visiting the farm. And so it seeks to provide some immunity for the farmer, for the owner, so the person hosting the agritourists, and to make it more likely that our farmers will invite people to their farm. Those issues, I'd like to stress, will be this bill is headed towards civil law, and my preference, it just seems makes sense that the immunity issues should be focused in that committee, and we'll address those very forthrightly there. But today I think it's our opportunity to talk more about agritourism and the role of farmers within that. So
Thank you, yeah. Representative Johnson. We do have a quorum now, so.
Oh, can I move my amendment then?
Okay.
Okay,
so
Michelle.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Thank you. So you can call up your first testifier then.
Yeah, Mr. Peterson.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we strongly support this legislation. I think many of you know I started working on this bill a few years ago with a group called Renewing the Countryside, and they're going to testify a little bit later today, which this bill is designed to reduce, as Representative Johnson said, some of the legal liability surrounding inherent risks on farms. Also started working with this bill with Representative Ron Szymanski, who a lot of you know or served with, who was an apple grower and supported this bill and believed in it. A lot of people are more interested in how their food's produced these days at all levels, whether you have a larger farm or a smaller farm. We have plot days on crop farms, or we have U-picks, we have CSAs have weed picking days. There's just a lot of different interaction now, and that's good. We want that. We want people to come out and see how we farm at all different types of ways. Just a couple other quick points I wanted to make. Many other states have passed similar legislation to this recently. Just this year, Oklahoma, Idaho, and Florida legislatures have passed this legislation, including some of our surrounding states, including South Dakota. Minnesota's had a similar law in the books for years. I was wondering about passing this around. I don't know if there's a page for livestock. And many of you know I'm involved in horse. I've been in the horse business most of my life. And we've had this a law for many years that includes the warning sign, whether you go to like a riding stable or a horse show. It does a couple of things. It not only provides us some protection, it also is a good warning to just people when they're coming out. I know people when they would come to my farm and they'd read that sign of their horse show and say, oh yeah, I'm at a horse show, I should pay a little more attention. And that's kind of the same idea, that we would get some of that value in having this. And also, if something did come up where it's an inherent risk, that would provide us with some other basic protection. So those are my comments and appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions? All right, thank you. Next on the testimony list is Mr. Busselman, I believe. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Doug Busselman. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau supports passage of HF 1829, and we appreciate Representative Johnson and the co-sponsors for this bill in bringing it forward. Farm Bureau policy seeks to limit farm and farm families from liability exposure for accidents resulting from inherent risk. Because of the disconnect with current agricultural production methods and the lack of understanding of how we raise food and fiber and why we carry out the practices we do, there is an urgent need to respond by showing non-farmers what is going on. Practicing the popular theme, Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, we have a direct wide range of events and even business models that strive to enhance more direct interaction with the public with agricultural activities that fit into the definition of the types of activities covered by this bill. Last fall, Minnesota Farm Bureau conducted a statewide survey of our 78 county Farm Bureau organizations, asking for their feedback on a number of agritourism types of activities that were involved with, that they were involved with, and the number of persons these activities involved. 49 county organizations responded to this information request, sharing the number of people that they bring to their farms for events like breakfast on the farm, school tours, safety camps, trade teams, and farm tours in general. All of these educational and relationship building activities fit into the type of definition for agritourism activities covered by this proposed legislation. Not all county farm bureaus engaged in each of these types of activities that we sought numbers for. Some did multiple activities and some only did one type of event. But through their work, our volunteers, and local organizations. The combined total of persons who visited the farms for these events was over 41,750 people. We believe that the objectives of HF 1829 and the provisions of the measure adequately and responsibly address important safety concerns that should be included in proper notification of participants, and that there are inherent risks which they should be aware of. Having been made aware of those types of things, those who do not wish to participate have the ability to make that decision. We appreciate this opportunity to express our support for the bill and encourage your favorable action for passage.
Thank you, Mr. Busselman. Are there any questions? All right, thank you. And next we have Mr. Hoffbauer. Welcome to the committee. If you first state your name, please.
My name is Douglas Hoffbauer. Yes, thank you for having me. I'm up out of the Duluth area where agriculture is rather scarce, and because of that, my farm, which is Christmas trees and vegetables at farmers markets, is quite a popular site for tours as far as like the Duluth Garden and Flower Club. And I also have been an active in several times as being a cooperator with the Grand Rapids Experiment Station to the university, having trial plots on my place. My concern is that this bill puts the liability of those visitors on me, and that really is the number one deterrent for me to have these field days. My insurance man gets nervous. He doesn't like to see it happen, and I'm just asking for a common sense approach to this issue, that if somebody does come on my farm to look at whatever the product is, that they assume those risks, that on a Christmas tree farm there are stumps and there's holes and there's rocks, and when you're out in a flower field that there are going to be bugs, there's going to be bees, and there's going to be things like that can cause problems. The demonstration plot issue is critical for the university's research to get out to the rest of the population, and I think that this bill will make that flow of information much more viable. The working farm and inherent risks, I think that's what needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you. And then we have... I'm not even going to think I can pronounce this person's last name. Is it?
Joedis.
Okay. So please come down to the table here and state your name, please.
Thank you. My name is Jan Joedis.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm with an organization called Renewing the Countryside. We're a nonprofit organization based in Minnesota. And have been around about a decade. We really work on issues that try and make rural areas, small towns, the countryside more vibrant and sustainable. And one of the issues that we work on has been agritourism. And a few years ago, we did a series of agritourism workshops across the state with people who were interested in diversifying their incomes using agritourism on their farms. And one of the issues that came up time and time again was this issue of liability and being concerned. Mainly farmers who had their insurance agents who were concerned about the liability of bringing people on the farm. And as the other people who have spoken about this have mentioned, there's such a great opportunity now because people are somewhat more removed from where their food and fiber comes from. This interest in connecting more with their past, we see just a growing interest with the local foods movement and farmers markets and people wanting to get out and participating. But there is this issue with farmers needing to have some protection, and this would be a great step forward in terms of enabling that and giving people more of a chance to do that. We continue to see greater and greater demand from the general public and more interest among farmers. As we heard, there's already a lot of this going on in a variety of different ways, and it helps the small farmers and the larger farmers by passing this bill. It would be an important step.
All right. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And maybe this question would be answered by our next testifier, but I just have a question, Representative Johnson, about the scope of the bill. In the definitions on the line 116, it talks about any person engaged in the business. It doesn't say farmer. Whether or not for compensation, But then up on the page or line 110, it says activities carried out on a farm or ranch. So are we talking about activities such as Farm Fest or Big Iron, for example, or just activities taking place on an actual farm or ranch?
Representative Johnson.
I understand it to be, as it says on 110, activities carried out on a farm or a ranch. And that, the, it's it, when we're thinking farm, I did check to make sure that included a timber farm. It doesn't, if you look at the definition of a farm, under 1.8 and 1.9, you can see the definition of what the farm or ranch is.
Any follow-up? No? Representative Wagenius.
A question along those same lines. I'm just trying to, I see your other products of farm or ranch, and one of the things I was thinking about is honey. And is that included in here? Or if somebody has bees. And it's just, I'm struggling a little bit with the definition, that's all.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, this is going to challenge me to answer this, but my thinking on I would need some help on that one. I'm going to have to defer because my thought process is that in honey operation, there's the honey house, and that's kind of almost a manufacturing operation. That's where the centrifuge is, and where the honey is separated and produced, but the out on the in the field where the hives are, the beekeepers I know they're placing those hives on someone else's land, and so whether that would be if they brought me to see their hives, I wouldn't be on their property, and so I guess that's an interesting question. I'm not so sure I can answer that.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think we ought to think that one through. It does seem to me that you might, you know, it's up to you, but it's just to think it through. I think it's a question. My second question was, on our farm, we grow a lot of prairie stuff, get a lot of seeds, but we don't sell anything. It's all research. But what about somebody who grows prairie plants just for the seed production to sell them? Is that included in this?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, another difficult question. It would be the question of a definition of is the seed considered an agricultural product? I would think it would be, but it's not for consumption itself. It's indirect consumption.
I don't know the answer to that question, and that's why I...
Nor do I.
Okay, those are my two questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. I'm just looking at like 1.8 and 1.9. I mean, it's horticultural, floricultural, viticultural, etc. I mean, if all of those things are encompassing, it appears that it would cover that. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, when you're looking at the block 1.10 through 1.15, it does describe or natural activities and attractions, harvest your own, farm stay, gleaning, those kinds of activities. I would think that, and we probably should make sure, but I would think that would include those kinds of activities. Also, the question would be is what about university studies where they have people coming and going to look at those fields that are studied. Now, some of those are done in private farms. They rent, you know, they use plots out of our fields. So I would assume that would, you would want that to protect, that would be part of agritourism in activities also. I don't know, you know.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, did you have any comments? I think, again, looking at when it's got some, when it uses the word or in different areas, like on 1.9, or other products of a farm or ranch, seems, again, all-encompassing. 1.12, or participate in rural activities, including farming, seems to encompass a lot of different things. So it may be all-encompassing here. It may be that you need to just be able to clarify that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I my inclination when I'm looking at it now for a whole minute with these questions in mind, that yes, it would be. I think it would be inclusive wherever it's involved with the product of the farm. That's what the focus is.
Very good. Any other questions? Yes. No? All right. I think you have at least one more testifier that's on the list. Mr. Carlson will come down. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson, and I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. Just want you to know that not only I personally, but the organization I represent is very pro-tourism. I don't think anybody has been around here, hasn't seen the resorters with their hats and beach balls and sunglasses that I've had the pleasure of working with for the past two decades. I also serve as a volunteer on the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, which is the single largest tourism location in the state of Minnesota. We have over 4 million visitors. It is the number one tourist attraction in the state. So I'm very pro-tourism, and we support this activity. I want to talk a little bit about the agriculture issues that we see related to the bill. We'll deal with some of the civil law issues in the civil law committee, but there are some agriculture issues that I would at least bring to your attention. Before I say that, just so you know, this is the first time that the legislature would grant this broad of protection or immunity to for-profit companies of any size for their negligent conduct. The legislature has never done that before. This is a pretty different change in policy, and the concern I have as it relates to agricultural activities, and I believe they are expansive and quite all-encompassing, is that they're not linked up to other areas of law that we require other businesses to adhere to. You know, we assume that when you go to a farm for an activity, that you may eat food at the farm that's produced at the farm. It's a logical extension of what's going to happen here. I've talked to the proponents and the author of the bill. We think that would happen. But there's no requirement here that they abide by Chapter 31, which is our safe food handling law in Minnesota. And when you couple the no requirement to comply with Chapter 31 and blanket immunity, you have the potential for some serious illnesses and injuries that I don't think obviously are intended, but I think it should link up between the food processing and handling chapter and Chapter 31 and this protection, so that if you're going there, at least they're going to abide by what we require other businesses to do that are feeding the public. Additionally, you know, this applies to wineries and farm wineries that are licensed under Chapter 340A, but yet there's no requirement that they operate under Chapter 340A, which means liquor liability insurance, or they're going to be serving wine to their patrons. None of that is linked up here, and that you also then grant an immunity and protection to that same business. And I just think there should be a link up there. Likewise, the bill on line 1.20 talks about a farm stay, an overnight stay for people that you are now charging to come to the farm and stay overnight at your house or your location. But there's no requirement that they comply like every other lodging establishment or resort with Chapter 157, which is our health department regulation of lodging establishments and restaurants. And so I think you should at least look at that, so that they are having, you know, a similar set of guidelines for people that are now renting out lodging to the public. And I just don't see a link up in the bill. And I think that it's something that you should at least talk about. And I know Mr. Peterson, who I've talked with several times on this issue, mentioned the existing law that we have for livestock activities. And I've handed out to the committee, and I want you to make a couple points about it, because you're setting up a pretty significant dichotomy in agricultural law. And that is in 604A.12, the definition of livestock immunity and some of the inherent risks, which this is the only place in law where we actually define inherent risks, is in 604A12. But you'll notice that this protection only applies to nonprofit corporations, people that are donating their services for the use or for a nonprofit corporation. And then you'll notice on the back of the handout that I gave you that this protection does not apply if their actions which cause an injury are willful or negligent. And negligence is the standard that we generally live by. And so you are now saying, with the way 1829 is written, that a for-profit company has a gross negligence or willful standard, and the not-for-profit 4-H operation is held to a negligent standard. And I don't think that that is the intent of what you're trying to get at, and I shared this with Mr. Johnson earlier today. I don't think that that is anyone's intent, but you have a completely different set of laws now for how a nonprofit would treat people that come onto their property and how a for-profit company would be treated, and the for-profit company now has better protection from the legislature than even a nonprofit company. And so those are just some of the concerns that we have about this. We support what they're trying to do. We think the legislature defining inherent risk and some of those legal things will deal with in the civil law committee, but trying to address, if it is an insurance issue that they're trying to address, I heard one of the witnesses say, and I didn't catch his name, I apologize, that the people coming there should assume the risk of doing it. I want you to know and have some comfort that our law already requires them to assume that risk. Chapter 604 requires you to assume the risk of your activity. It's only when someone else's conduct that increases that risk and causes you an injury where they have any liability. And I understand the insurance people want to make them nervous about their exposure, and that's not a bad thing, but they don't have that liability right now. It's only when they have when their action causes an injury where they have any liability at all. So, Madam Chair, I appreciate your indulgence on this. We're happy to work with the author and others as it moves forward. And, David, Representative Dill's had liability issues we've worked through. Representative Anderson's had grazing issues that we've worked through. We can work our way through this, but right now this one's written pretty broad and I think has a lot of unintended consequences.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We have a couple of people on the list. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess... trying to think about this, but some of Mr. Carlson's comments raised a question for me. So if I were to go to, say, a farm, a milk or dairy farm, and they were offering samples there, and I know that raw milk has become kind of an issue, would there be any requirement to tell a patron that that product has either been pasteurized or not? Or is that part of that inherent liability that the person is unassuming? Because I imagine that, if you're handed a glass of milk and said, hey, you want to sample this, but you don't know if it's actually been pasteurized or not, that might be something that a person wants to know.
And Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Buck, you raised, kind of the key issue here, which is the legislature can't really determine every fact situation. You can't determine what every inherent risk of an activity is. I would say that in that situation, without a requirement that that they label, which is not required in here, or they or are subject to safe food handling under Chapter 31, that they would not have liability unless they were grossly negligent under the bill, which is, we define, and I went through this also with Mr. Johnson today, is essentially no care at all. And so that's, the problem with, without kind of linking up what their responsibility is with, with what the activity might be. And so you've hit the kind of nail on the head, whether it's milk or eggs or turnips.
Mm-hmm. Representative Paul.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I come from a farm background, too. I understand this, but I know that there's certain, and I don't dairy farm, but I know my neighbors didn't. They would drink raw milk from their farm and they were fine with it, but there's also dairy farmers that are very adamantly opposed to the selling of raw milk. So do you have two separate negligence standards? If you have one farm that or farmer that supports making sure that the product is pasteurized and one that says that we don't, because certain people want to consume raw milk, but their standard of whether or not it should be pasteurized or belief in it is different. So, I mean, we've got, you know, even people in the same area of farming, you know, same commodity essentially, that have different standards of practice.
I think Mr. that's Carlson. A very logical but unintended outcome of the way the bill is written.
Okay. That probably needs some work. Thank you.
All right. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice to be back in Ag Policy again and to see everybody here. Mr. Carlson, it seems to me, if I'm kind of reading, hearing what you're saying, if I could paraphrase it, one of your bigger concerns is exempting from gross negligence versus just standard negligence. Could you help define for me the difference between regular negligence and gross negligence?
Sure.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, this is probably why people don't like to go to civil law, but negligence is an ordinary person standard. What would a reasonable person do in a reasonable situation? And if they deviate from that, they do something unreasonable, they breach their duty of reasonable care, and that is negligence. Gross negligence is a lack of care. It's a very high degree of negligence. This bill, I think, also mentions reckless behavior. So you're talking about, you know, the general laws that apply to everybody, which is to use, you know, reasonable care, wouldn't apply to these businesses. And gross negligence, which is used very infrequently in our statute, is an exceedingly high standard that would be almost impossible for someone to establish. It is the equivalent of taking action to injure you. So if you really are going onto the farm at a gross negligence standard at your own risk, and we think it's maybe too high of a risk, particularly when you're talking about children that are going to go on school trips and that don't really have the capacity to anticipate you know, the dangers that may be on the farm, and to have a gross negligence standard in those kinds of areas we think is just too far. We're not saying that we shouldn't promote ag tourism and it can be done safely and it should be done, but that gross negligence is just too high of a standard.
Representative Petersburg.
Well, thank you for that. And so if I understand you right, if the bill eliminated the gross part and went just to negligence, you would have more of a approval rating on it. But the follow-up question to that is would that then be necessary since we all assume normal accountability for our own actions?
Mr. Carlson.
You know what? That's a great question because we get that all the time. Are we just recodifying what is existing law already? But as I've talked to a number of groups who have looked for these kinds of laws, we do think that there can be benefit in letting the public know what, you know, what they are assuming when they go on the property, and whether it's a negligence standard, which does give us more comfort because that's closer to what the common law is and I think should be. But having a statute that says we promote ag tourism, we want them to post warnings that there may be a risk of injury, we don't think those are bad things. Many of the things in the bill are helpful to get people to know, hey, I better be aware here. Now, you know, the 3-year-old or 4-year-old is not going to be aware, but the parents are. We're hopeful. And so that can be a good thing. But having the legislature say the hole in the ground is that you stepped in and broke your leg on was an inherent risk when you don't know the facts or circumstances or what they did, defining an inherent risk legislatively is really an impossibility. It's very difficult.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And this kind of, I guess, gets into two, looking for free legal advice. And you've really touched on this well. And appreciate your
phone a friend.
Comment on this. But I think a concern farmers have is hunters coming on their land, for example, and whether with permission or not, and somebody falling in that proverbial hole and getting hurt. And this would, I think, would address that to a point. But a lot of other points have been raised about, will this protect a farmer, especially if he didn't give somebody permission, I guess is what I'm looking at. Your thoughts on that.
Sure.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, just so the committee knows, this doesn't have anything to do with hunting or fishing, and is not part of the bill at all, and we have a separate statute on that for recreational purpose in 604A, I believe it's 2-1, that deals with entry onto land for hunting activities. And the landowner in that situation, whether you're trespassing on the property and not supposed to be there, or they allow people onto their property, they do receive protection from the legislature for that recreational activity. We have a statute for people that dedicate their land or donate their land for trail use. But even they have a higher standard than gross negligence. They have the standard of duty of care of what we owe to a trespasser, which is not to take any action to injure them. But then further, if we know of something that would injure them, the landowner has a duty to warn them or repair it if it's children, because if children are going to be present, they won't anticipate the danger. So this actually even goes a little bit further than what landowners get right now. But this doesn't, as I read the definitions, wouldn't apply in that hunting situation. But we do have a law that deals with that right now.
Thank you. No further questions being
Thank
noted.
You,
Thank
Chair.
You for participating in this verbal bar exam. It was appreciated to learn some of that. And I have no one else on the list, but is there anyone in the public here that would like to testify for or against the bill as it's been presented and amended? And as you come forward, please just state your name for the record.
Santo Cruz, Department of Agriculture. Madam Chair, yes. Members of the committee, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Minnesota Grown Program publishes an annual directory of nearly 1,000 farms that sell directly to the end consumer. These include apple orchards, Christmas tree farms, as been stated, farms, wineries, pick-your-own farms, corn mazes, pumpkin patches, farms offering tours, and many, many more. Nearly all of these farms would benefit from the legislation to help limit the on-farm liability. Members of MDA's Minnesota Grown Advisory Committee are familiar with this legislation as amended and have reacted very positively to it. The Department of Agriculture's support for this legislation is strong and sees it as a critical step towards growing Minnesota's agritourism economy. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Cruz? All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
So I believe if there's no one else to testify or to comment on the bill, then Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I'd just like to finish by saying that after certainly hearing from the Department of Agriculture, but also others, I think we're in the process of rethinking farming a little bit. And a lot of times our image is the ranch or the corn and bean farm or the wheat farm, but increasingly access to agriculture is through alternative forms like vegetable farms and smaller farms and new ways, and the Department of Agriculture is promoting that. And that part of the stimulus for certainly that sort of activity can be offering opportunities for those entrepreneurs, for those new farmers to have another source of income whereby they can actually have tourist activities associated with that new kind of farming. And I think that's another encouragement for other people to be involved in farming. And I think when I think about the history of this state and our culture, that's important. We always want to have new people coming into farming. But I go back to my fundamental reason for this, and that is it's important that Minnesotans understand agriculture. We have fewer people farming. We have people more diverse, further away from the farm and have less access to extended family. But we want folks to know what agriculture is. It helps the industry, and it helps build a firm and important understanding for agriculture in Minnesota. So I ask for a yes vote on this. Thank you.
All right, and so this will be referred to civil law, and we have the bill as amended before us. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The bill will move on to civil law. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And now we have Representative Benson. And as Representative Benson comes up, many of you, I'm sure, have gotten numerous emails on this bill, and we'll hear a similar kind of bill, I guess, in some form next week, but I just wanted to, after talking to Representative Benson and in consultation with the Republican lead on this committee, Representative Hamilton, the suggestion has been made, and we are following through on that, that we are just laying this bill over. We will hear the testimony today. We will not vote on the bill. We will just hear it and lay it over. So I'm going to turn it over to Representative Benson. We have a number of people. I think there are seven different people that have signed up to participate with testimony, and if we will conclude by 2 p.m. So go ahead, Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for being willing to hear House File 391. Just a little background on why I'm coming to you with this kind of a bill. Going all the way back to 2006, when I first entered the legislature, a number of bills having to do with animals, animal care, whether it was the puppy mill bill or all those kinds of things, were swirling around. And you may remember a name, Tom Tilbury. He was a representative who worked on those bills a great deal and found it to be quite frustrating. And for some reason, he decided that maybe I could try some of these. And so once you get engaged and identified with a particular area, you get stuck with, and I think many of the members here can recognize that happening to them and in other areas. And, you know, my personal background is quite different from the district I now represent, because I grew up, as the chair knows, close to Austin, Minnesota. My grandparents, when they came from Europe, spent the first several years in Albert Lea, Minnesota, where my mother retired after selling her two small farms to one of my brothers. And so I grew up on a dairy farm, and at the age of 11, with my 16-year-old brother, we found ourselves running the family farm after my father's deceased. And so I was a dairy farmer, actually milking cows at 11 years old, which was a big shock. And I only mention that because when you represent a district like mine, which is sometimes called the Gold Coast, Minnetonka, Wayzata area, people, especially from who represent greater Minnesota, would say, what is this fellow doing presenting these kinds of bills? So I want to claim that I am part of the same kind of cultural background as everybody else that who might be interested in this topic. Shep Harris, who has been working with me and others on issues similar to this and will be here in a while, I'm sure, brought this bill to me. And I told him very clearly that after the experiences I had with puppy mill legislation and other items similar to that, that I was not interested in moving forward unless we could find some consensus within the community of animal care shelters and so. We had a meeting then in my office, and Mr. Clark, who represents Ms. Lee Kramer, Kathy Mock, and I believe Janelle Dixon, if I remember, were there along with Shep Harris and Mike Fry, who you will meet here in a moment. And I asked all of them that that they would, in good faith, meet together off campus at their convenience and go through the bill line by line. And Mr. Harris made clear, and I made clear, and Mr. Fry made clear that if there were any problems with the bill or it seemed to be extending too far, that the Humane Society representatives would tell us about that. They indicated in our discussion in my office that they found there were several good things in the bill that they felt they probably could support, but they wanted to be able to go through it. And so I suggested that the groups get together and discuss it. They did meet, and I was not at that meeting, but my understanding is it broke up very quickly, and no progress was made, and I'm not prepared to point a finger at anyone other than to say that I'm very disappointed that the promise that was given to me as a state legislator was not followed through. I met then with Mr. Harris and Mr. Fry about what we should do with the fact that we had this piece of legislation, and then it came to my attention that a letter from Minnesota representatives in opposition to the bill was published. Clark nor anyone else who was in opposition found it necessary to tell me about it. I found about it secondhand. So let's just say I'm displeased with the process. We'll leave it at that at the moment. But I find the commentary in this letter of opposition troubling. First of all, because no one approached me about it. They do not acknowledge in the letter that I had proposed to allow deletion of any items which they found objectionable. They chose not to give me such a list nor discuss it with me. But right now, since this is an informational hearing, I think it would be more important if we move on and quickly look through what the bill actually does contain. Now, the overview is a very good one. The staff person who wrote it has hit the highlights. I always found that when one was presenting something and one's colleagues had it all in writing before them, simply reading through all that is kind of a put down. We might have someone who's unable to read the English language. So unless there is a question about what the terminology and so means, I would rather at this point, because of the pressure of time, ask our testifiers to come up here and make their statements, and then they could answer questions, and maybe I can as well. Would that be acceptable to you, Madam Chair?
That would be fine. Representative Benson, we can move forward with the testifiers at this point. I do have a list of seven names that are on here, and I'm going to go in accordance to the order that has been given to me as an update here. So I'm going to start with Janelle Dixon and ask that Ms. Dixon come forward and please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Janelle Dixon. I've been working in animal welfare for more than 22 years.
Ms. Dixon, would you just move the mic a little bit closer to you? Thank you.
Is that better?
That's better.
Again, my name is Janelle Dixon. I'm the president and CEO of Animal Humane Society. I'm also the chair of the board of the National Federation of Humane Societies. I'm a board advisory member of Shelter Animals Count. I'm a member of the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine Dean's Advisory Council. I co-founded the Minnesota Partnership for Animal Welfare, and I serve on various advisory capacities locally and nationally. And I just say that by way of understanding the experience and breadth of experience I have in the industry in animal welfare. Just a little bit about Animal Humane Society. It was founded in 1878. We are the oldest animal welfare organization in the state. We are the largest organization in the state and in the upper Midwest, and one of the largest organizations in the country. We operate five facilities in the metro area, Coon Rapids, Woodbury, St. Paul, Golden Valley, and Buffalo. We admit about 22,000, a little more than 22,000 animals in 2013. We have an 82% live release rate, and we partner with an organization called Kindest Cut to provide low-cost services to the public to get their animals spayed and neutered for those who qualify and can't afford otherwise. Additionally, we aid about 7,000 to 10,000 animals in the field each year through our Humane Investigations Program, and we have a comprehensive list of services that we provide in addition to intake and adoption that include animal training, boarding, education, emergency housing, and a host of other things. In addition to that, we partner with more than 30 agencies locally and nationally to provide services for animals and see that they get rehomed. One of the organizations locally we work with is Leech Lake Legacy, addressing issues on Leech Lake Indian Reservation. Our organization is opposed to House File 391, and like Representative Benson, we have been dissatisfied with the process. This bill has been something that's in play for 3 years, and it wasn't until 1 week before the legislative session was to start that we were asked to provide any comment or give any opinion. We did not, in fact, say that we supported any component of this bill, only that in theory there were some components of the bill that we thought were potentially advisable, and there are things that we've been thinking about from our organization's perspective that should be in state law at some point in the future. I'd say general comments. This bill is based on a single agenda, and it was not developed to meet the needs of the organizations in the state of Minnesota, the animals, or the people in the state of Minnesota. It's based on a national template, and if you go to a website called rescue50.org, you'll see that it's essentially verbatim from the model legislation that was put on that. And there is an effort nationally to try and get this legislation passed in every state. In animal welfare, nationally, it's referred to as CAPA. We find this bill to be far-reaching and overly dictatorial in defining what it is and how an organization can deliver services. It ties the hands of agencies to do what they see best for the welfare of the animals in their care. It's also an unfunded mandate for service delivery that would significantly impact local private sheltering organizations as well as public animal control facilities. It uses the number of cages in a facility as the standard for care. This is ill-conceived. The standard must be based on an organization's capacity for care, which includes the number of staff and volunteers it has, as well as the monetary resources it has to provide care for animals. Filling cages and doubling animals up in cages is not the way that you care for animals. It is inadequate, and it's an inadequate way to care for them, and really what that is hoarding. It's not animal welfare. Lastly, I'd say in general, before I move on to some specific components of the bill, the use of the language of kill in this bill, I think, is highly offensive and demeaning to the people who work in animal welfare. And I guess I would ask, how many of you have companion animals or have had in your life? How many of you have had to make a euthanasia decision and the life of? When you made that decision to end the life of your animal, did you consider yourself to be killing your animal? I would highly doubt it. You are bringing a compassionate end of life. And euthanasia is really at the heart of the components of what's trying to be put forward. And I guess I ask you to think about in that perspective as you consider what you're going to hear today from people. Some of the primary concerns we have is that the private and public sheltering definitions are really challenging. We are a private agency. We are not a public agency. We do provide impound care housing contracts with some cities particularly in Washington County. There's about 20 municipalities that we contract with. Each local municipality is required to provide animal control services. They often can provide the impoundment authority through the police or an animal control officer, but they don't have the provisions to care for those animals, and we contract to provide that care. We are not doing the public seizure of those animals. If they were to change the definition that would require our organization to be public, it would then subject us to public reporting requirements and Freedom of Information Act requirements, and we think that that is inappropriate and out of line for a private organization such as ourselves. And that would hold across the board and not just within the context of this legislation. The required holding periods for owner-surrendered animals are unnecessary. It increases the length of stay for animals without cause. This can lead to overcrowding, direct resources that have to be extended to providing that care rather than services that could help save the animal's life through medical or behavioral treatment. And additionally, it can increase the incidence of illness in the shelter and spread of disease. People do not spontaneously decide to surrender their animals. Research has shown that it is a week-long or month-long process before someone comes to the point of feeling like their only option is to surrender. So giving that animal 3 additional days in the shelter for someone to possibly change their mind is very uncommon. I wouldn't say that it has never happened, but it's very unusual and unlikely. And legislating to the exception is really not in the benefit of the 22,000+ animals that we care for, not to mention the thousands of animals that other organizations care for on an animal basis. Additionally, we get animals that are surrendered for animal end-of-life services, and it would be inhumane to keep those animals for 3 days before providing those services. The registry for process for rescues is something that we're also concerned about. Right now, there's a very low bar for an organization to be able to come in and take animals from an organization. If they're not being convicted or criminally investigated for animal neglect or cruelty, they qualify. We have relationships with many, many organizations that we have a level of trust with, that we know that they're going to take good care. In this bill, basically any organization that puts itself forward, we would be required to release animals to them. Many of those organizations are high quality and do fantastic work, but some of them are actually hoarders. We have situations through our investigations program where organizations and individuals that have represented themselves as rescues have been convicted of cruelty for hoarding animals in their basements. And we don't want to be in a place where we have to release animals to them. Doesn't it allow us to make the types of considerations that we need to make to ensure quality care? Another thing that the bill implies and assumes is that there is unlimited capacity in rescue and that they're miraculously going to be able to take dozens or hundreds of animals from organizations. Rescues in this state are very limited. We have a very hard time getting rescues who have space to be able to take animals from us that we want to find alternatives for. And so this will only really lead to significant overcrowding in organizations and difficult health issues. We have concerns about the personal service to last known address for strays. Animal Humane Society in 2013 took in 4,839 strays. This is not a manageable situation for us to go to the front door of every stray animal that we know an address to try and get that animal back to them. Again, that's where we're talking about an unfunded mandate. Who's going to pay for that? If we were required to do that, that may make our organization have to make different decisions about whether or not we would be able to provide services for strays. And if we did that, that means your local municipalities that need to be funded by city and state funding would have to take on that cost and take on that responsibility, one that, for the most part, we don't charge cities for. Of that 4,000+ animals, nearly 5,000, 981 of them only came from our municipal contracts, of which we get any kind of fee for that care that we provide. The rest of it's done at our cost. certification of an agency head. In this bill, it required that I certify personally any animal that's euthanized that we couldn't find any other alternative for. That's not my responsibility. It is my responsibility to ensure that people are hired who can make the decisions that are best for animals. We have 8 veterinarians that work at Animal Humane Society. That's their responsibility. It would be unreasonable given the other responsibilities that I have to make sure our organization is viable and professional in its work. Again, the public accountability piece, we're very concerned about that. And then, I guess, lastly, enforcement. Right now, the way that this bill is stated to be enforced basically pits one animal welfare organization against another. There's no legal authority that's looking after this. It just says that one organization can take legal action to try and force another organization to do something if they think they're not acting in good faith with the bill. So with that, I've given you a lot of information. There's a lot of components in here. It isn't that Animal Humane Society is opposed to a process or having something in place that ensures that there are good standards of care for animals. This bill doesn't do that, and the process that has been used so far to bring this to the committee's attention has been inadequate, inappropriate, and has not in any way engaged the stakeholders in this community and in this state to ensure that the right language and the right provisions are in place to see that that happens.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to move on to Elaine Hansen, and just a note that we have 30 minutes. We have 6 more people to testify, so we'd like to be able to move as quickly as possible, but we recognize that people are passionate about this issue and will have some comments. So Elaine Hansen.
My name is Elaine Hansen. I represent the Minnesota Council of Dog Clubs. You're going to like this presentation. It's going to take about 1 minute. Actually, I did not prepare any presentation or specific remarks. I'm here simply to let you know that the Minnesota Council of Dog Clubs supports the bill and is very glad to see this committee giving it a hearing. I understand that you're going to lay it over, and I hope that in doing so, it will be able to come back for further consideration and eventually pass. We have some concerns about some of the details in the bill as well. They don't happen to be the same concerns that Ms. Dixon pointed out. However, the bill overall is a good one. We think that it's appropriate to hold accountable, at least on a statistical basis and a record-keeping basis, the agencies, public and private, that take care of animals that are not owned or are separated from their owners. I did hear Ms. Dixon say her belief that if the bill passes, the Animal Humane Society would become a public agency subject to the Freedom of Information Act. That puzzles me a great deal. I'm a retired state employee. The state agencies are public, but not all public organizations are state agencies. And in Minnesota, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act is the law that pertains to records kept by any unit of government. So that puzzles me. I may talk with her and look into it further, but I don't see that that's actually a concern. I thank you for having the opportunity. I think maybe my minute is up or over. I'm anxious to hear what other speakers have to say, however, and I hope that this bill will be passed, possibly with some modifications as appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Next on the agenda is any questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Just a point of clarification, Madam Chair. Are the testifiers talking about the original bill or the delete all amendment?
Thank you for that clarification. We are just talking about the original bill at this point. The delete all is just out there for consideration. But as we had a conversation with Representative Hamilton and Representative Benson, we're just going with the original bill. There's still controversy about what's the best amendable bill. So I think we just found it more prudent, since it was on the table, to just go with the original bill. Thanks for the clarification. And now we'll go with Mr. Fry.
Yes, thank you. You actually probably have Larry Tucker on your list next. He was coming from Austin, Texas, couldn't make it. So he has emailed a letter that I've included in your packets that is my handout for the committee. I'm not going to read the letter just for sake of time, but I will let you know Larry Tucker is the chair of the Animal Advisory Commission in the city of Austin, Texas. That's an official government structure that they have to oversee shelters at the city of Austin, Texas. He was chair of the Animal Advisory Commission before, during, and after the implementation of this law as a city ordinance in Austin, Texas. And his letter of strong endorsement, I think, is a clear indication that the fear-mongering that you sometimes hear from the opposition is not true. Those things didn't happen. At the city of Austin, Texas, animal shelter, actually, their killing at the shelter went from more than 50% to, within a year, practically overnight, like flipping a light switch, they're now saving 93% of all of the animals that come through the open admission Austin, Texas Animal Control Center. It did not cost the city of Texas one additional dime in their operating budget in order to make that happen. And now they're saying morale at the animal shelter is at an all-time high. The public support of the officials who passed that ordinance is at an all-time high. It's a point of celebration throughout the city. Last week they celebrated their 3-year anniversary at being the largest no-kill community in the United States. I have a packet I wanted to get through, and I will swear I'll be very quick. I just wanted to address a couple of the pieces of Ms. Dixon's testimony, because if you listen very carefully, I think there's some hints into things that she said that will help you understand why this conversation's been very challenging and difficult. One thing that she said was that by adding a 3-day holding period for owner-surrendered animals, it would increase the length of stay for owner-surrendered animals in their shelter and prevent them from getting, you know, medical care and things. If you actually read the bill, none of that's true. In the bill that's written, as it's originally written, an owner-surrendered pet can be transferred to a rescue group. They can be adopted from the facility. The only thing that they can't do is kill it if it's healthy. That's what she's opposing. They can be euthanized. I'm sorry. And the other thing I do want to bring up is that she did draw a distinction about the language between euthanizing and killing. And I know I myself have had to euthanize pets, but I do think that it's important for us sometimes to draw a distinction between ending the life of a perfectly healthy animal for a convenience purpose and ending the life of a terminally ill animal that is actually going to benefit. It's in the animal's interest if we end that life. That, to me, is how I use the term euthanasia. So if I slip up and call killing a healthy animal killing, I apologize. And I would argue most every point, I could, you know, take another 15 minutes and go through every point Ms. Dixon made, but I think if you, and counter every one of them, but if you read the bill, I think that you'll find that that's kind of universally true about nearly every single thing that she said, and that's why these problems haven't come up. But what I would really like to talk to you about today is why your email inboxes have been full, with all kinds of people opposing and supporting from all over the United States, and why actually Ms. Dixon should have been able to have a better understanding of this bill before a couple of weeks ago. Because the fact of the matter, this has been the law of the land in California for 13 years, and yes, there has been a national discussion about this going on for a very long time, and she's clearly been aware of it and been part of it because, as she indicated clearly, she's been sitting on all these various national boards. And I'm going to talk a little about that national conversation and why this bill is so important in Minnesota and elsewhere. And so the first thing I'd like to point out is in your handout, I'd like to just actually flip through the handout if you don't mind. You can take it, keep it, and study it for later. The first fallacy that we have to eliminate is the idea that everybody who works in an animal welfare or an animal shelter is really concerned about the welfare of animals. That's just not true. And if you ask yourself a basic question, how many animal lovers would line up to work at a facility where killing animals or euthanizing animals is a regular part of the all-day-long activities? The answer, intuitively, you can guess, is probably very few, which is why on this opening page you can see PETA statistics, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. We all know who they are, right? The folks who have a reputation for throwing fake blood on people who wear fur coats. Well, they actually have an animal shelter in Norfolk, Virginia. And what people don't know is that if you look at their statistics for 2013, 93% of the pets that came through that facility were either euthanized, or they were transferred to other facilities who primarily euthanized. 93%. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And the only reason we know that is because the state of Virginia, where their shelter exists, has a transparency law that requires them to report that. So I can go to the state of Virginia website and download those statistics. And the next few pages, actually, in your handout, are the actual downloaded report of PETA's statistics from that supposed shelter in Norfolk, Virginia. And it's not as though PETA is alone in that sort of process. The Humane Society of the United States, we've all heard of them. We know about them. They make a lot of show on television when they do these large-scale arrests and seizures of animals. But how many people ask, what actually happens to those animals after those arrests occur? And think about this. The Humane Society of the United States, here's a hint, they don't run any animal shelters in the United States or elsewhere. Nowhere. And so those animals just sort of disappear into a black hole, and most people don't know what happens to them, except for in a handful of areas. If you look at the next page after the Humane Society of the United States, here's one example that animal advocates have been able to discover. And it was an arrest that occurred in Wilkes County, North Carolina. There were 130 dogs seized via the HSUS. Shortly thereafter, of course, the letters went out, the donate for us links were all over the internet, but most people don't know what happened to the dogs. In reality, there were 130 dogs seized, 140 dogs were killed. And that what happened was there were a handful of those dogs that were pregnant. They gave birth in foster homes, and HSUS requested that all of the dogs, including the puppies that were born in foster care, be killed and euthanized, and they were. And the biggest problem with that is HSUS doesn't run shelters, but they do have a program where they run around the United States teaching other animal shelters how to operate. So they don't operate shelters, but they teach the other shelters how to operate. And so what we have are shelters in the United States, in Minnesota, that operate just like that Wilkes County massacre. In Minnesota, we had what we call the St. Anthony cats, where there were 130 cats seized from a so-called hoarding situation, while the organization that took those cats was on television asking for help and donations to care for the cats, and while they were saying publicly to the news media that they were going to hold those cats for 2 to 3 weeks so that they could evaluate them, they were already in the back room euthanizing those cats, and within 48 hours, every one of those 130 cats was dead. And in your literature, you can see what they told everybody is the cats were so sick they needed to be put down, but we actually have photos of the cats in your handout, and they look pretty robust and healthy from my perspective. And unfortunately, there's also a transcript of phone calls that we've made to local animal shelters. They unfortunately, when people call and talk about surrendering their pets, they will tell those callers that euthanasia is the absolute last resort. They will say things like, we only euthanize for terminal illness or severe aggression, and that it's the absolute last resort. And Ms. Dixon clearly said, oftentimes, you know, people struggle with the decision to surrender pets, but they're making the final decision based on the information that they're hearing from those animal shelters. And oftentimes the information they're getting is incorrect. And they surrender their pets, they go home and come back the same day because they've changed their mind and they find out that their pet is dead already. And then I get those phone calls. I would argue there are a lot of reasons why we need this bill. It has not only passed in Austin, it's passed as policy in shelters throughout the United States, and it's saving the lives everywhere. And I've never heard any of the horror stories actually occur that are being predicted. I'd like to thank you all for your time. You've been absolutely gracious over the last days and weeks, and a special thanks also to Representative Benson for his hard work, and I urge you strongly to vote yes.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Fry? All right, thank you. Next on the agenda is Lynn Watson. Lynn Watson. And if there's no Lynn Watson, do we have a Dr. Linda Wolf? Okay, Dr. Linda Wolf. Thank you. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Dr. Linda Wolf, thank you for having me. I'll try to make this short and sweet, too. I've been in the field of veterinary medicine for over 40 years. I've been able to participate and or watch the progress or lack of progress in the animal shelter rescue field for that amount of time. Minnesota has led the way in animal field, really good stuff in many arenas. As an ag committee, you probably are very well aware of the late Dr. John Anderson, who developed the individual calf hutches to reduce stress and illnesses. That went worldwide. It got Minnesota really, really known for how we care about animals, even our agricultural animals. I'm proud of Minnesota and its tendency to be forward-thinking and forward-leading, and I want to see that carried out in the companion animal arena. I think this Protection Act, given a few little tweaks, would be a very fitting addition towards that goal. Right now, there are thousands of savable, and I use that term as it's defined, healthy or treatable companion animals that are being euthanized, even though there may be space available at shelters or rescue groups. I acknowledge that space isn't the only criteria that you need manpower
and you need finances to do it. But there's many reasons or excuses for happening, this type of thing happening. I think the Act could provide a really solid foundation to turn this situation around, and I think would actually help some shelters and rescue groups help with their decision-making process. One issue I think this will help address is that I have a real thing about feeling that we need to first focus on the animals that need rescue and shelter services right here in Minnesota. Often we hear there's no space available. One of the reasons is that there's been a tendency lately that space is being taken by rescues, and I do use that term loosely in some situations, but these are being imported from out of state. In fact, thousands of animals are being imported into Minnesota from outside Minnesota to rescue shelter organizations. It's a glamorous kind of rescue, but the situation does fill shelters, rescue groups, and foster homes when I feel we really need to address and care for Minnesota animals first and foremost. And then after we get stabilized in our own communities, then we can look to other states, countries that need our help. I think this Companion Act would really help make that happen. As a side note, importing animals from other areas of the country or even other countries brings about very important medical issues of the introduction of diseases, parasites, etc., that are not indigenous to our area or are in very low level in Minnesota. I have to say kudos to the agricultural community. You've been long aware of those kind of dangers about animal import, and you've set really stringent standards about trying to avoid disease importation. Again, in my opinion, Minnesota shelters and rescues should take care of our problem here first. I think this act would place that emphasis on savable Minnesota animals. There's another issue in the bill about euthanasia, and believe me, I've done my fair share over 40 years of euthanizing animals. Bottom line, euthanasia in Greek means the good death. But we're still killing an animal when we euthanize, bottom line. So it's semantics. I can't fathom any arguments against requiring euthanasia procedure be done by injectable agents that cause the least amount of stress and pain and doing it in an environment that reduces stress. That's what's addressed in this particular bill about euthanasia. I've lectured for years on euthanasia methods, and if anyone wants to talk to me about it, not that I'd be happy to talk about euthanasia, but I'd be more than willing to if it comes with this bill. I hope Minnesota does become a leader in this area of animal sheltering and rescue, and I really feel that this bill, again, given a few tweaks, would really go towards that end. And it's some of the stuff that you have talked about in the new amended, whatever you want to call it. I'm not knowledgeable about
the delete amendments.
The delete amendment bill. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'm available. I live in Minnesota. I travel nationally to lecture and consult, but you can always get a hold of me. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Dr. Jane Piratosi. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record as you begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. It's Jane Piratosi. I'm the executive director of Faithful Friends Animal Society, and we are in Wilmington, Delaware. We are an animal welfare agency, and we've been around about 13 years in our state. And I wanted to let you know a little bit about Delaware quickly if you don't know about us. We have about 900,000 people in our state, so we're a small state. We have three counties, two of which are rural counties. I'm also a member of the State Animal Welfare Task Force. Our agency started 13 years ago because we've grappled with the same issues that you're grappling with. We, at that time, found that our state had generally an 80 to 90% kill rate. And what we found was that we had a very closed system, whereas we couldn't get information from our shelters as to why animals were dying, to what the standards of care were, even when we attempted to get that information. And the public did not have the statistics from the shelters. So at that point, we went to our legislature, just like Representative Benson is helping you, and we presented the information we learned from what was going on nationally and what was going on in our state. And what we found was that shelters were still operating in an old method of gathering up animals and killing animals, regardless of whether they were healthy, treatable, and adoptable. And a lot of the reasons we received from shelter leadership as to why things couldn't change were really excuses we found. There was a lack of basic standards of care in shelters. There were a lot of empty cages, and animals were still being killed. There was an unwillingness to share data, or the data didn't match up. And animals were being imported by the thousands into our small state, while others were being killed. So in 2010, we felt it was necessary to advance our animal welfare policy by passing what we called a shelter standard law, which is what I think you're calling an accountability and protection act. And the mention of it being a boilerplate law, there is a national organization that suggests some language to improve your policies in your state. We worked with our shelters and our veterinarian association, and we looked at the boilerplate and we adjusted it to make it work for the needs of our state. What we found was that most states are grappling with the same problems, and many of the issues do apply. We passed our Companion Animal Protection Act and put it into law in 2010. We had unanimous support from our governor and from all of our legislators, because what we felt was that every animal who enters any shelter should be given dignity and have every chance at adoption and have some basic standards of care, just like we have in child care systems, in nursing homes in our state, for human services. And so we put something in place that would address that for our state, which is similar to your law that's being proposed. Right now, CAPA has been very successful in our state. We're saving about 15,000 dogs and cats a year since its implementation in 2010. It's reduced the unnecessary intake of some animals and reduced the killing of some animals. And it's done that by saying large numbers of cages shouldn't be left empty and healthy animals being killed in shelters in anticipation that more animals might come in, by requiring basic vaccinations upon intake to reduce disease, and taking steps, asking the shelters to take steps to find animals other resources, whether it be another rescue, another shelter, a foster home, doubling up animals only when it's appropriate. In 2009, before this law passed in our state, we were taking in 22,438 dogs and cats, and by 2012, that dropped to 13,596 dogs and cats. This was a drop in intake of close to 9,000 animals. And when I was asked about that and we looked at our numbers, there was a big drop in the number of cats coming in. And that was actually a good thing, because what we found was that shelters were bringing in thousands upon thousands of feral cats that don't belong in shelters. And the only fate for them is to be killed. And it also costs money to bring them into the shelter. And also, cats that were not feral or were owned did not have a hold period. So if you owned your cat and it went missing, it could be killed the same day. So we also had a hold period put in our law. But what we found was that really a lot of these cats still belong in the community. It wasn't solving the problem of all the cats in the community. Every state grapples with it. And instead, we've been working with rescue groups and other shelters to educate the community and to do more spay-neuter in the community of cats and to vaccinate and just to bring in adoptable cats and kittens. And now we have several towns that have adopted that model as well. Our euthanasia rate in Delaware is now reported at 15%, or we have about an 85% save rate. And our goal is to get that down to about a 95% save rate for our state, which we believe we can do with the support of our legislature. Our euthanasia rate basically dropped from 9,000 animals being killed in Delaware in 2009 to about 2,000 animals in 2012, saving about 7,000 animals. And again, much of that is not bringing in animals that don't belong in the shelter, reuniting them with their families in the field before they come into a shelter, and also really breaking down the barriers of shelters that weren't willing to work with rescues and breeders that were reputable in our community. We really felt that we needed this law as well, because what we found was that when a shelter got a new leader, the save rates could go up or down depending on that leader's philosophy. And we didn't think it was appropriate for the animals to be subject to life or death based on the new director's philosophy. So having some basic standards of care we could agree on Having some public accountability for reporting requirements of statistics was all very critical to advance our animal welfare system in Delaware, which is what you're trying to do here. And we never want to go back to the dark ages, which is how we felt we were in before this law passed. And we're not done just because this law passed. We have an animal welfare task force that continues to work with our legislature to look at our outcomes, look at any issues we're having, and to make improvements where we need to. We passed the law unanimously in our legislature, in the House and the Senate, and we felt that was partly due to the fact that we did get input from the other shelters in the law as we developed it, but also we were really under the radar screen of a few of the national groups that have opposed new laws that support better shelter work. And those same national groups that you heard about that Mike mentioned really have not helped the states grappling with this issue to tackle why the animals are dying in such large numbers. Again, we hope that you will pass a law similar to what you proposed today, maybe with some changes, so you can advance the protection of animals who really can't speak for themselves and are really right now subject to whatever leadership is in charge at the different shelters.
Thank you for your testimony. You represented Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question about feral cats, wild cats, in which you said you were finding that your shelters were accepting a lot of those, and now you're not. Two points, just briefly.
Sure.
So where do those feral cats go, and wouldn't that automatically increase your live rate release if you eliminate them out of the equation?
Sure. And really what happened was is when we were researching what other states were doing, we talked to New Hampshire that has a really good save rate. And they said that what they did was all their shelters just agreed we shouldn't be taking in feral cats unless they're injured and need medical care. There are hundreds and thousands of feral cats across this country. Delaware alone, we estimate, has about 200,000. We're not going to round them all up and kill them. And right now, when you take some in and you kill them, more just come in from another neighborhood. It's called the vacuum effect, and that's proven. When you spay and neuter them and support the community in doing that, you start to reduce the population completely over time. And so that's what we've been doing in Delaware, and many towns and municipalities have taken hold of it and found that the community now is a part of the solution. Instead of certain neighborhoods just bringing them in, neighbors are coming together and being part of that solution.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt this. If you have further discussion questions, I just got a note. I have to be in taxes or having a vote. Can I just make a brief comment, and then if you will allow me, I will leave. And that is, I had a very nice visit with Representative Hamilton, the lead of your committee. He and I agreed that we do not agree on all kinds of things politically, but I told him that his personal integrity, when he gives his word, is absolute. That's the gold standard. I am convinced that if he and I and others who are interested, including the Humane Society, are prepared in good conscience to work through this, we can come up with something that would achieve near unanimous support as well. As you know, I had a delete all, which reduced my bill down to practically nothing. All that was left was the process by which euthanasia would be carried through, not to have gas chambers and those kinds of activities. So I want to give the committee and Chair Poppe my thank you for giving us so much time and your generosity, and let us continue to work on this. We all know this is a short session, and I'm sorry I've been pushing all these delete alls at you, but I think that shows my good intentions and my willingness to work through this process.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Thank you for the others that testified. And Representative Petersburg, would you be interested in moving the minutes from our last meeting?
I would very well appreciate that. I move the minutes of the last meeting.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and thank you for your testimony. Thank you to the members that stuck it out. Meeting adjourned.